King Alfred. In the event of widespread and continuing and coordinated racial disturbances in the United States, King Alfred, at the discretion of the president, is to be put into action immediately. Participating federal agencies, National Security Council, Central Intelligence Agency, Federal Bureau of Investigation, Department of Justice, Department of Defense, Department of Interior. Participating state agencies under federal jurisdiction, National Guard units, state police. Participating local agencies under federal jurisdiction, city police and county police. And by the way, on the origin of the name, it says, next to an asterisk, 849 through 899, King of England, directed translation from the Latin of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle.
I should just mention before we get into the King Alfred plan in seriously that...
Continuing now with the King Alfred plan, having taken care of our FCC duties. Memo, National Security Council. Even before 1954, when the Supreme Court of the United States of America declared unconstitutional separate educational and recreational facilities, racial unrest and discord had become very nearly a part of the American way of life. But that way of life was repugnant to most Americans. Since 1954, however, that unrest and discord have broken out into widespread violence, which increasingly have placed the peace and stability of the nation in dire jeopardy. This violence has resulted in loss of life, limb, and property, and has cost the taxpayers of this nation billions of dollars. And the end is not yet in sight. This same violence has raised the tremendously grave question as to whether the races can ever live in peace with each other. Each passing month has brought new intelligence that, despite new laws passed to alleviate the condition of the minority, and minority is capitalized in this document, the minority still is not satisfied. Demonstrations and rioting have become a part of the familiar scene. Troops have been called out in city after city across the land, and our image as a world leader severely damaged. Our enemies press closer, seeking the advantage, possibly at a time during one of these outbreaks of violence. The minority has adopted an almost military posture to gain its objectives, which are not clear to most Americans. It is expected, therefore, that when those objectives are denied the minority, racial war must be considered inevitable. When that emergency comes, and emergency is also capitalized, we must expect the total involvement of all 22 million members of the minority, men, women, and children, for once this project is launched, its goal is to terminate, once and for all, the minority threat to the whole of American society and, indeed, the free world. Chairman, National Security Council. Preliminary Memo, Department of Interior. Under King Alfred, the nation has been divided into 10 regions. See accompanying map. In case of emergency, minority members will be evacuated from the cities by federalized National Guard units, local and state police, and, if necessary, by units of the regular armed forces using public and military transportation and detained in nearby military installations until a further course of action has been decided. And then it lists the various regions here, and I would note that there are 10 of them, and I'm going to come back to that in a second. One, capital region, that's obviously Washington, D.C. Two, northeast region. Three, southeast region. Four, Great Lakes region. Five, South Central Region, 6, Deep South Region, 7, Deep South Region 2, 8, Great Plains Rocky Mountain Region, 9, Southwest Region, 10, A and B, West Coast Region, A being north, apparently Washington and Oregon from the map, B being down in Southern California. Then the memo goes on, no attempt will be made to seal off the Canadian and Mexican borders. Before continuing with the King Alfred plan, I'd just like to hearken back to a provision here of Rex 84. And let me go back.
Rex 84, for those of you who are in the middle of this and are trying to follow and having a little problem, Rex 84, remember, is the confirmed plan mentioned at some length in the Sheehan affidavit that was put together by Oliver North and the folks over at FEMA Management. And we're going to be reading a short segment here down in the footnotes from the Sheehan affidavit about the some interesting correspondences between Rex 84 and the putative King Alfred plan.
Right. Now, going from King Alfred plan back to the Sheehan affidavit, it says here, According to Rex, it says, first, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, after deputizing all DOD personnel and state National Guard personnel, ostensibly so as to make such personnel civilians and to thereby avoid violating the congressionally enacted Posse Comitatus Act, would undertake to test its ability to seek out and to take into custody some 400,000 undocumented Central American aliens throughout the United States, and then to intern said Central American aliens in 10 military detention centers to be established during this Rex 84 readiness exercise. And in a footnote, it points out that these are to be 1. Fort Drum, New York, 2. Fort Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania, 3. Fort A.P. Hill outside of the District of Columbia in Virginia, 4. Fort Benning, Georgia, 5. Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, 6. Camp Chrome, Florida, this base to serve as the jointly FEMA INS Administration Interrogation Center, 7. Fort Chaffee in Arkansas, 8. Fort Wachuska, Arizona, which was also to serve as the U.S.-based Ground Communication Center for Operation Night Train, and 9. Eglin Air Force Base in California, and 1. Outside of Oakdale, California. There is a remarkably close degree of correspondence between the 10 regional detention centers outlined under Rex 84 and the 10 regions under the King Alfred Plan. Continuing with the King Alfred Plan, we felt it was important to point out that unnerving similarity. Combined memo, Department of Justice, Federal Bureau of Investigation, Central Intelligence Agency. There are 12 major minority organizations, and all are familiar to the 22 million. Dossiers have been compiled on the leaders of the organizations and can be studied in Washington. The material contained in many of the dossiers, and our threat to reveal that material, has considerably held in check the activities of some of the leaders. Leaders who do not have such usable material in their dossiers have been approached to take government posts, mostly as ambassadors and primarily in African countries. The promise of these positions also has materially contributed to a temporary slowdown of minority activities. However, we do not expect these slowdowns to be of long duration because there are always new and dissonant elements joining these organizations with the potential power to replace the old leaders. All organizations and their leaders are under constant 24-hour surveillance. The organizations are 1. The Black Muslims, 2. Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, 3. Congress of Racial Equality, 4. The Uhuru Movement, 5. The Group on Advanced Leadership, or GOAL, 6. The Freedom Now Party, 7. United Black Nationalists of America, 8. The New Pan-African Movement, 9. Southern Christian Leadership Conference, 10. The National Urban League, 11. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and 12. The Committee on Racial and Religious Progress. Note: at the appropriate time, to be designated by the president, the leaders of some of these organizations are to be detained only when it is clear that they cannot prevent the emergency, working with local public officials during the first critical hours. All other leaders are to be detained at once. Compiled lists of minority leaders have been readied at the National Data Computer Center. It is necessary to use the minority leaders designated by the president in much the same manner in which we use minority members who are agents with central and federal. That, of course, interrupting refers to the CIA and FBI, and we cannot, until there is no alternative, reveal King Alfred in all its aspects. Minority members of Congress will be unseated at once. This move is not without precedent in American history. That from the Attorney General.
Continuing with the King Alfred Plan from the man who cried, I am. Preliminary memo, Department of Defense. This memo is being submitted in lieu of a full report from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That report is now in preparation. There will be many cities where the minority will be able to put into the street a superior number of people with a desperate and dangerous will. He will be a formidable enemy, for he is bound to the continent by heritage and knows that political asylum will not be available to him in other countries. The greatest concentration of the minority is in the Deep South and Eastern Seaboard, the Great Lakes region, and the West Coast. While the national population exceeds that of the minority by more than 10 times, we must realistically take into account the following. 1. An estimated 40-50% of the white population will not, for various reasons, engage the minority during an emergency. 2. American armed forces are spread around the world. A break out of war abroad means fewer troops at home to handle the emergency. 3. Local law enforcement officials must contain the emergency until help arrives, though it may mean fighting a superior force. New York City, for example, has a 25,000-man police force, but there are about 1 million minority members in the city. We are confident that the minority could hold any city it took for only a few hours. The lack of weapons, facilities, logistics, all put the minority at a final disadvantage. Since the Korean War, this department has shifted minority members of the armed forces to combat to areas where combat is most likely to occur, with the aim of eliminating, through combat, as many combat-trained minority servicemen as possible. Today, the ratio of minority member combat deaths in Vietnam, where they are serving as, quote, advisors, unquote, is twice as high as the minority population ratio to the rest of America. Below is the timetable for King Alfred as tentatively suggested by the JCS, Joint Chiefs of Staff, who recommend that the operation be made over a period of 8 hours. 1. Local police and minority leaders in action to head off the emergency. 2. Countdown to 8 hours begins at the moment the president determines the emergency to be A. national, B. coordinated, C. of long duration. 8th hour. 3. County police join local police in the 7th hour. In the 6th hour, state police join county and local forces. The 5th, federal marshals join state, county, and local forces. 4th, National Guards federalized, held in readiness. Regular armed forces alerted, take up positions. Minority troops divided and detained along with all white sympathizers under guard. 8. That's in the 3rd hour, excuse me. In the second hour, all minority leaders, national and local, detained. President addresses minority on radio television, gives it 1 hour to end the emergency, the first. And then, 0 hour, all units under regional commands into the emergency. Zero committee report.
That may, but I was just wondering, that may be O committee, like O for committee. Operational committee.
You may be right. Survey shows that during a 6-year period, production created 9 million objects, or 1,500,000 each year. Production could not dispose of the containers, which proved a bottleneck. However, that was almost 20 years ago. We suggest that vaporization techniques be employed to overcome the production problems inherent in King Alfred. Signed, Secretary of Defense.
I think that last little part there, the O Committee report, might be worth rereading, Nip, just because it's so it doesn't strike one at first. And I think listeners should listen very carefully to the language here. The units they're talking about are black people.
And they're talking, the production that they're talking, they're referring to production of 20 years before, and we all know what this is, supposedly is something written in the mid-60s, 20 years before that, of course, being during World War II, production being incapable of keeping up with the demand, so to speak. Again, reading from O Committee report, survey shows that during a 6-year period, production created 9 million objects, or 1.5 million each year. Production could not dispose of the containers, which proved a bottleneck. However, that was almost 20 years ago. We suggest that vaporization techniques be employed to overcome the production problems inherent in King Alfred.
Vaporization, of course. Referring to liquidation.
Yes, and referring to not being able to get rid of the bodies fast enough, basically, mm-hmm. to put it in simple terms. Again, we've gone through lengthy disclaimers of the King Alfred plan, but again, put into the context of...
Really contingency disclaimers, that
yes,
would be a good
exactly.
way of putting it.
But put into the context of what we know about Rex 84, what we know about Louis Jafrida's War College plans, then later updated by John Brinkerhoff, his deputy, Rex 84 and King Alfred begin to look more and more alike all the time.
And again, the remarkable treatment, again, when Mae Brussels sent this to us, the very able and courageous researcher from whom we obtained this, the first copy was intercepted in the mail, never arrived. The second copy was intercepted in the mail and never arrived. The third one took a good 2 weeks to arrive, but to take a mail trip that should have taken a day or two at the most. And the fact that our network of informants has told us that this is, in fact, a real document, that John Williams was not able to come out and say so simply because of the controversial nature, led us to go with it at the time. We're glad we did, simply because now it is very obvious from the headlines that have emerged, this is a real policy, it is a real National Security Council contingency, and the similarity between the emergency, unquote, the 10 readiness centers, the 10 zones, and in particular, one wonders about King Alfred and Rex 84. It is our feeling that at this point, the undivided energies of those researchers who operate in good faith have to be devoted, should be devoted, to determining, among other things, just whether or not the King Alfred plan is, in fact, the work, the groundwork for Rex 84.
I have a feeling, as a matter of fact, that if it is, if there are differences between Rex 84 as it exists now and what was the King Alfred plan, we will probably find that it was merely a slight shift in focus on the victims of the plan, and perhaps to include, again, as they mentioned, Central Americans considered to be dangerous, certain blacks, intellectuals, sympathizers, etc., perhaps not so specifically targeted at the, quote, the American Negro, the minority problem, as it would have been back in the late 60s and early 70s. But the substance very much the same, no doubt, and chillingly so. We are going to take a break and let you think about Oliver and his secret army, et cetera, et cetera, and take about 5 or 6, 8 minutes, who knows, run around, stretch our legs, let you stretch yours, and maybe let your tape recorder cool off or something. And we will be back with more of Radio Free America. This is Nip Tuck with Dave Emery here in the studios at KFUV here until 11 o'clock tonight. Just a couple of things wanted to mention very quickly, of course, for those of you who are taping. This is the fourth part of the Iran-Contra series. It's Radio Free America number 32. The fourth part of the Iran-Contra series, the third part of the terrorism segment of the Iran-Contra series, with at least one more coming up on the cover-up. And what else do I want to mention? Oh, and last thing to mention real quickly for the last time probably tonight. We've been talking about the Sheehan affidavit, and there is a videotape of a Daniel Sheehan press conference available at Tower Records, donated by one of our listeners, and you should go down and rent it if you haven't had a chance to see Daniel Sheehan in action. He's talking about much of the same stuff that we're talking about, and more power to him. Anyway, what we have just finished talking about, for those of you who are just tuning in and heard music and wondered what the heck happened to One Step Beyond, again, we are doing Radio Free America tonight. We started a little earlier, and we have been talking first, of course, about Oliver's army, the secret contingency plans Rex 84 put together by such luminaries as Oliver North, William Casey, William Clark, Ed Meese, and the stalwarts at the Federal Emergency Management Agency under Louis Jeffreda. And talking about how the plan that they put together for martial law, which included, among other things, deputizing America's homegrown fascists, Nazis and Klan paramilitary types, and sending them out to round up political undesirables, this plan, Rex 84, how very similar Rex 84 now revealed, among other things, in some articles by Alfonso Chardy of the Miami Herald, how similar Rex 84 appears to a supposedly apocryphal martial law plan called the King Alfred Plan, which we now have reason to believe, if not exactly identical to the Rex 84 plan, close enough that it sounds very much like King Alfred Plan is a real thing, and Rex 84 was only the most recent wrinkle of said plan. So we've been talking about that, a plan, the King Alfred Plan, of course, being a martial law plan put forward in the 60s to round up black militant, round up all blacks at a time of an uprising by political uprising by black Americans, and round them all up and take them to extermination camps.
And to use, quote, vaporization techniques,
that's
unquote.
Right, to prevent problems with container buildup.
And again, some of the revelations under the Rex 84 plan have taken the King Alfred plan, regrettably, out of the realm of fiction. What we're going to be looking at for most of the broadcast this evening is an equally chilling scenario, namely the suggestion that many of the terrorist incidents that have been plaguing the world in the last few years have in fact been set up by elements of the U.S. national security establishment in order to drive a bulldozer through the Bill of Rights at home, to restrict civil liberties at home, and to warrant military expansionism abroad. Again, very similar to the Reichstag scenario, where Hitler was appointed chancellor, burned down the German parliament, the Reichstag, blamed it on the communists, and then used that as an excuse to suspend the constitution of Germany, assume dictatorial powers, and later provocation was used by Hitler to warrant foreign intervention. A faked incident at the Polish border at a town called Gliwice was used as the pretext to invade Poland. Germany claimed that Poland attacked them after having machine guns, some concentration camp inmates, and their Wehrmacht and SS guards in order to make it look as though Poland had attacked them. The reason we raise this scenario is not only because that is the specialty of the Triple Wilson team, provocation, but there are numerous and very disturbing connections between elements of the American national security establishment, in particular people grouped around Oliver North and the Iran-Contra team, and many of the most heinous terrorist groups, including some of the terrorist groups this team was most active against, at least if we are to believe the cover story. A good example of that last type of that last scenario was carried in the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, April 20th of 1987. This is a story by Miguel Acoca. I'm not sure how his name is pronounced. A-C-O-C-A of the Examiner Washington Bureau. It's Dateline Washington headlined, North Link to Top Syrian Arms Dealer. A billionaire Syrian weapons dealer and drug trafficker, linked to the hijacking of the Aquile Loro, was paid for arms he sold to the Nicaraguan rebels from a bank account controlled by Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, sources here and in Europe said. The weapons merchant, who operates from a palatial mansion in Spain's Costa del Sol, is Mansour Al-Kassar, last name Al-Kassar, 40, member of a prominent Syrian family, a broker for the Polish and North Korean state-owned arms industries, and a weapons supplier to Palestinian extremists in Western Europe and the Middle East, sources said. He made at least three major weapons shipments of Polish AK-47s, ammunition, rocket launchers, and SAM-7 anti-aircraft missiles to the U.S.-backed Contra rebels in 1984 and 85, the sources said. North's Contra supply network continued to buy from Al-Kassar with money from a Swiss bank account, despite official British warnings to the United States about Al-Kassar's background, the London Observer has reported. North is the former National Security Council aide who was fired last November for his involvement in the Iran-Contra affair. The New York Newsday newspaper, reporting Monday on the Al-Kassar-North connection, said it was unclear how North's private arms network approached Al-Kassar. And turning to the inside part of the article. Let's see. The New York Newsday newspaper, reporting Monday on the Al-Kassar-North connection, said it was unclear how North's private arms network approached Al-Kassar for the weaponry or whether the buyers knew of his background. But one recently retired intelligence official told the newspaper, quote, "The first time I ever threw his, Al-Kassar's name out, not knowing who he was, every alarm bell in Christendom rang. Then we quickly stepped back because we found out we had a cobra by the tail," unquote. The former intelligence officer said Al-Kassar's family, including several brothers, is, quote, "reputed to be the largest drug and arms-dealing family in Syria," unquote. He said Al-Kassar buys arms wholesale for the Palestine Liberation Organization, which then retails them for profit. Newsday said a U.S. criminal record document dealing with Al-Kassar bears the label terrorist at the top of the page and claims he, quote, has alleged ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is controlled by Dr. George Habash. The weapons shipped by Al-Kassar were shipped to Central America through the Portuguese firm Defex Portugal, the sources said. At least one weapons load went by air from Warsaw to Lisbon aboard a state-owned Polish airliner, one source said. Al-Kassar also bought weapons for the Contras through a British firm and sold weapons to Iran, sources said. The certificates necessary to ship the weapons from Portugal were provided by Honduran and Guatemalan military officers with close ties to the CIA and the Pentagon. Defex Portugal was associated with Energy Resources International, a Panamanian corporation that made at least 19 shipments from Lisbon to the Contras between 1984 and 6, according to Portuguese intelligence sources. Energy Resources was controlled by former CIA and military officers working for North. The former officers ran the Contra operation during the 1984-86 congressional ban on direct or indirect American military supplies for the rebels. Energy Resources is owned by Stanford Technology Corporation, a California firm controlled by Albert Hakim of Los Gatos. We'll be coming back to that later. Hakim is a business associate of retired Air Force Major General Richard Secord. North also was a leading player in the Reagan administration's counterterrorism operations and in secret weapon sales to Iran. His activities in the Iran-Contra scandal are the object of investigations by two congressional committees and independent counsel Lawrence Walsh. Public congressional hearings on the scandal are scheduled to open May 5th. The irony in Al-Kassar's involvement with the Contras is his link to Mohammed Abbas, A-B-B-A-S, the terrorist leader who allegedly masterminded the hijacking of the Aquile Loro cruise ship. North was widely applauded in 1985 for organizing the mid-air interception of the airliner carrying Abbas following the hijacking of the ship in Egypt. Abbas, who was wanted in the United States for the murder of U.S. hostage Leon Klinghoffer on the Italian ship, was subsequently released by Italian authorities. Al-Kassar also has been linked to Abu Nidal, another terrorist wanted by U.S. authorities, sources said. Abu Nidal's real name is Sabri Albana. Several things to take note of here. First of all, the link of a major player in the Oliver North Contra supply effort of someone connected not only to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine by George Habash, one of the top Palestinian terrorist groups, but also, perhaps more importantly for our purposes, to Abdul Abbas, rather, the fellow behind the Achille Lauro hijacking, and Abu Nidal, one of the prime movers on the international terrorist scene today, is intriguing. And again, it's worth noting that Oliver North himself has gained much political mileage from his alleged opposition to these very same groups. Also take note of the fact that this particular operation here was carried out by a company owned by Stanford Technology Corporation here in the Silicon Valley. We're going to come back to Stanford Technology, its links, namely International Imaging Systems, with another company called TCI, and some other things here in just a second. But again, worth thinking about the connections between Oliver North, the All-American Patriot, and the very forces he would have us believe he's working against. The question that we're asking is, does this association of others like it indicate, in fact, that if he's not an actual ally of these people, that he is willing to use them consciously in order to generate some of the effects that we have hinted at?
This bit of information linking Oliver North and his organization with folks linked to Abu Nidal also put something, before I read the next article, I wanted to throw something in that I had noted before and didn't really have a context for it, but this seems like an interesting context, of a rather curious lie that Oliver North told during the course of the questioning going on most recently. This was in the earlier Alexander Coburn column or article that we read from In These Times, and it's just a short paragraph here, but it is rather strange, and put in the light of some of the things we've just been talking about, it may make more sense. Coburn writes, "A telling example of North's lying was his fervent tribute to the, quote, brave Major Steiner, who arrested the Achille Lauro hijackers as they stepped onto Italian soil from the plane forced down by U.S. fighters and handed them over to the Italian authorities." Now, that's what Oliver North claimed happened. This bears no resemblance to what actually happened. As news accounts made clear at the time, U.S. and Italian security personnel were present when the skyjacked plane landed. The Italian Carabinieri, which is the Italian police, got to the plane first and took charge of the Achille Lauro hijackers. The U.S. force on the tarmac, presumably commanded by the redoubtable Major Steiner, demanded that the Italians hand over the hijackers, hoping to fly them to the U.S. But after what was described at the time as a gunpoint confrontation, Steiner and his men backed down, and the Italians took the hijackers away. Rather interesting in light of Oliver North's own involvement with the, or at least connections to the Achille Lauro case, that he should tell such a blatant lie about the circumstances having to do with the capture of Abu Abbas and the fact that American forces should be trying to take these prisoners from the Italians on Italian soil at gunpoint. It does raise some interesting questions. Now we're going to go on and read an article published in the San Francisco Chronicle for Friday, July 17th, 1987, that goes into this in a little more detail. The article is headlined, "North's Network Dealt with Man Tied to Abu Nidal." The article is by Michael Wines of the Los Angeles Times, and it's datelined Washington. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North's secret arms network supplied Nicaraguan rebels with $1.5 million in weapons bought in 1985 and 1986 from a Syrian smuggler tied to terrorist Abu Nidal, according to records released by the Congressional Iran-Contra Panel. The weapons, apparently of Polish origin, were purchased from Mansour al-Kassar, a Damascus drug smuggler and arms merchant. The 42-year-old Kassar and his three brothers have built a multi-million-dollar empire on military deals in communist and Western Europe. Administration officials, speaking on condition that they not be named, said that Kassar has clearly established business links to the Abu Nidal terrorist ring, responsible for a November 1985 Egypt Air hijacking in which 57 persons died, and for December 1985 massacres in the Rome and Vienna airports. The congressional records point up a particular irony for North, who dramatically invoked a death threat by Abu Nidal in testimony last week to explain his acceptance of a $16,000 security system financed with cash from North's network. Lebanese terrorists claiming to represent Abu Nidal placed North's name on an assassination list last year, apparently because of his work on U.S. counterterrorism policies. So again, pointing up the fact of the Abu Nidal network somehow, strangely, in the person of Mansour al-Kassar and his brethren, he and his brethren's empire, being connected to Oliver North's putative anti-terrorist organization. But as we have seen so much in the past, especially with his secret team, Ed Wilson, Frank Turple et al., Richard Secord, the whole group of them, Shackley and Clines, have spent 35 years or so, most of them, doing just this, taking so-called terrorist organizations, infiltrating them, taking them over or directing them and using them as excuses for, as Dave put it, the dissolution of American civil liberties at home and the expansion of U.S. military presence abroad. That being the case, we should look at Oliver North's contacts with Abu Nidal, perhaps in the light of being a little more than just a sort of another ironic detail in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Yeah, again, I think people might want to think about Oliver North, the kind of person he represents in a symbolic sense, and ask one how someone like that could possibly have dealt with people like this if he is to be taken at face value, and obviously we feel that perhaps he is not. And again, the Rex 84 scenario should be brought to mind here. More information concerning this particular deal, the Manzar Al-Qassar deal, emerged in the San Jose Mercury News of Monday, April 20th of 1987. This is a story headlined, Terror Suspect Dealt in Contra Arms. This is from an article alluded to in the Examiner article I read a few minutes ago. This is by Newt Royce of Newsday, K-N-U-T-R-O-Y-C-E. Again, headline, Terror Suspect Dealt in Contra Arms, subheaded North's Aid Network Handled Purchase. Skipping down in the article, we find the following. Some of this will be by way of review. Al-Qassar's 158 tons of arms for the Contras, including AK-47 assault rifles and ammunition, were put aboard a Panamanian freighter, the Eria, E-R-R-I-A, which then steamed out of the Polish port of Szczecin on July 10th. Published accounts, which have not disclosed Al-Qassar's role in the arms transaction, have said that the Eria was purchased on April 28th by Hakim through a Panamanian shell company, Dolmy Business Incorporated. Dolmy is D-O-L-M-Y. The arms were purchased by another Panamanian corporation, Energy Resources International, which is owned by the Stanford Technology Corporation, a California firm controlled by Hakim. Secord is Hakim's associate in the Stanford Technology Trading Group in the Virginia suburbs of Washington. Secord's attorney Thomas C. Green did not return calls to his office, nor did Hakim's attorney N. Richard Janis. North's attorney Brendan Sullivan could not be reached for comment. Al-Qassar could not be reached at his Vienna, Austria firm, Alcastronic, and there are no telephone listings for his residences in Vienna or the resort town of Marbella, Spain, where he is said to spend most of his time. I would take note of the Qassar presence in Vienna. That may or may not be significant. We'll comment on it later. Sources said Al-Qassar acted as a middleman in the deal. They said he purchased the arms from Cenzin, C-E-N-Z-I-N, the Polish agency that controls foreign trade, and then sold them to North Group. Details on the buying and selling prices and the financing arrangements could not be learned. Skipping down in the article of the Odyssey of the Aria with all of these Al-Qassar purchased weapons, the author writes, So the 358 tons of arms remained aboard the Aria, which lingered off Portugal for nearly 2 months. In early September, however, the ship traveled to the French port of Cherbourg and unloaded the entire cargo on the port's munition dock September 13th. A second ship, the Iceland Saga, picked up the arms and on September 20th set sail for Puerto Barrios, Guatemala. Two sources said they think that at this time, the CIA agreed to buy the arms through an American arms dealer, James P. Atwood, A-T-W-O-O-D, for $1.4 million. One source said that the arms had a retail value of $5.5 million and that Hakim and Secord had been trying to get more than $2 million for the shipment. There are a number of things in this story that we're going to take up at some length and we're going to look at against the background of the Achille Lauro hijacking. However, the name James P. Atwood is very significant for our purposes here. He is not only an arms dealer who's reportedly done a lot of work for the U.S. intelligence community in the past, he is an associate not only of Frank Turple's, but also of an arms for drug smuggling ring we looked at in Radio Free America number 26. Sometimes I forget the name. It was number 26, called The Company, quote unquote. Now, that's not The Company, quote unquote, namely the insider's nickname for the CIA, but rather it's called The Company, quote unquote. Although it appears that The Company may, in fact, work with the company, and James P. Atwood is one of the reasons why, and if that sounds confusing, we're now going to try and straighten out that confusion.
We're going to do our best. It is very confusing, and again, we're talking about, in the next article we're going to read, when they refer to the company, the reference is to, in fact, the supposedly private organization known as the company, a guns and drug smuggling operation that has cropped up in a variety of cases, most recently including the murder of Judge John Woods down in Texas, the only federal judge ever to be assassinated. He was sitting in on a very important drugs case, and the man who was convicted of killing him claimed to have been one of the gunmen in the JFK assassination, with some rather interesting backup for his story. So the company crops up in a lot of rather interesting places.
Again, for background on this, for people who would like to explore this further, Radio Free America number 26, our archive show on file, goes into the company at some length. And incidentally, we will be coming back to the company in a big way in our program about the cover-up, because President Reagan's recent nominee to head up the FBI, Judge William Sessions, was the fellow who presided over the trial of Charles Harrelson, for the assassination of Judge John Wood. So we're going to come back to that. The company, the Wood assassination, very significant for our purposes here.
That's right. But in the upcoming article, again, as mentioned, the company here refers to the supposedly private organization, not the nickname for the CIA. But as you will see, as so many often happens in these cases, the gray area is very large, and where one company ends and the other begins is some matter for debate. Anyway, what we're going to read for here is an unpublished manuscript by Jonathan Marshall that was, I guess it's the original draft for Parapolitics number 1. Parapolitics, a newsletter put together by Jonathan Marshall with the help of some other folks. Jonathan Marshall is currently editorial page editor for the Oakland Tribune. And again, we've used his work. He's also worked a great deal with Ted Rubenstein, who we have had a lot of help from and gotten a lot of good research work from. Anyway, reading from a draft for Parapolitics number 1. One of the key figures in the company was John Etheridge, Etheridge. John Etheridge, who surrendered last fall and is now cooperating with the authorities. He was a former aide to Congressman John Jenrett Jr., who was defeated for re-election following his conviction in the Abscam case. According to a source familiar with the case, Etheridge was also the go-between for Frank Turple and Colonel James Atwood, an international gun dealer who sold large caches of arms abroad, particularly to Latin America. Should just insert, again, Atwood was the man mentioned in the last story that Dave read as being the supplier for some of the Contra arms supplies. Atwood had a history of service for U.S. intelligence agencies and is widely rumored to have done favors for the CIA, although he denies it. In 1978, he leased an island estate in a Salt Creek near Savannah, Georgia, to Bradley Bryant, kingpin of the Philadelphia branch of the company. Some unconfirmed sources claim that the estate doubled as some kind of mercenary training center. Bryant and Atwood fell out later in the year, and Atwood booted his associate out. So again, the connection here between John Etheridge, a man who, among other things, worked for not only the company itself, but also for John Jenrett. Jenrett, of course, remembered from the Abscam case, and his lovely wife, Rita Jenrett, who, among other things, helped to drive the fugitive Frank Turple to the airport so he could flee the country. And he has never come back, at least not publicly. Again, the link between Etheridge being the go-between between Turple and the aforementioned Colonel James Atwood, international gun dealer, and also apparently a part of Oliver North's little network.
And again, Jeb Bradley Bryant of the company also retained the services of James Atwood for a relatively short period. Harkening back to a couple of the connections of the company that we talked about in Radio Free America 26, before we go on with some more information about the company, one of the things that we brought to mind was not only that Charles Harrelson, the fellow eventually convicted of assassinating Judge John Wood, he claimed a couple of interesting things. He claimed that the Drug Enforcement Administration had Judge Wood killed in order to cover up their own role as conspirators in the narcotics traffic. In Radio Free America number 29, as well as our four-part series, or was it 5-part series on the intelligence services' role in the narcotics traffic, revealed that, in fact, such a claim is far from fantastic. Also, Harrelson claimed that he was one of the triggermen in the assassination of John Kennedy, and in an interesting article by Gary Mack, an assassination researcher, We saw connecting links between Charles Harrelson and a number of Dallas-area organized crime figures involving, among others, Jack Ruby, and intersecting with the organized crime network of Santos Traficante. Santos Traficante investigated by the House Select Committee on Assassinations following his boast, or because of his boast that Kennedy would be assassinated long before Kennedy was, and he gave the scenario. Worth noting, because Santos Traficante, as we looked at in RFA number 29, was a key member of what the Christic Institute termed the shooter's team, and many members of the secret team go back to Station JM Wave, headed by Theodore Shackley, the campaign on the Bay of Pigs, and the Santos Traficante shooter's team. That's why we bring it up here, and we'll be coming back to it in the cover-up section.
Just wanted to mention real quickly that Charles Harrelson's allegations about the DEA and about his suggestion that the DEA had bumped off Judge Woods to cover up their own involvement in the drug traffic did not come after. It came sometime before the breaking of the Iran-Contra story, which, of course, brought a lot of this stuff out in the public eye and made it a lot more politically possible to come forward and say, yeah, we were working for the Drug Enforcement Agency, or we were working for the CIA when we were illegally smuggling drugs, as many currently indicted drug dealers have said, most of them probably with great truthfulness. However, Harrelson's case was actually up, what, in
1979 or 80,
yeah. And long before any of this stuff had come out, and at the time, of course, as usually happens, is regarded as the purest sort of fantasy by most people. But again, as we have one step beyond, and Mae Russell listeners have known for a long time, and as most of the public is now getting a chance to sort of know since the Iran-Contra thing broke, these kinds of things are going on all the time, and Charles Harrelson's words begin to seem more and more truthful as time goes by.